I am Angela Leung from the University of Hong Kong, and I'm the chairperson of the plenary of this morning. This morning, we have the great pleasure of listening to Dr. Aya Humay, who is the Wellcome Trust Fellow at the University of Manchester. Dr. Humay was trained in the University of Manchester, and she has taught at the University of Cambridge and has done research at the Needham Research Institute. She is the author of many interesting work on science, technology, and medicine in modern Japan and Asia. She has done work on nursing, on midwifery, and Japanese modern science and politics. She is the author of many articles, and one of her recent published books is with Michael Warboys, an important book on fungal diseases in Britain and the USA from 1850 to 2000, a recent book. And she's now involved in an extremely interesting project, which is called Family Planning, Health Promotion, and Global Medicine After the War, so roughly 1945 to 1995. Activities of Japan health campaigners around the world. This title is extremely fascinating and intriguing. So today, Dr. Humay is going to speak on doing East Asian history of science, technology, and medicine in the early 20th century, the case of Japanese family planning in Cold War Asia. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Aya Humay.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your introduction, Angela. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to talk in front of you, and I would like to thank you all for having woken up so early in the morning to catch this talk. And I would like to thank you all for organizers who are actually organizing this wonderful event, and to you, especially Catherine Jami, who's invited me to give me this opportunity. I'm very honored and delighted. So yesterday I was talking to my colleague Sonia Kim, and then she actually said, "I'm very looking forward to your talk today, tomorrow. You're going to talk about doing science and technology medicine in today." And then I thought, "No, I'm going to talk about history of science, technology, medicine," and that actually prompted me to have a look at the title finally, and then realize that I made a serious typo mistake. So I have included H between EA and STM. So please accept my apology if you have actually imagined something else. I hope I'm going to live up to the expectation, but I'm going to talk about doing history of science and technology in medicine in the 21st century. So basically, I'm going to talk about what we are doing right now. Okay, so for the last 6 years, my institutional home has been in East Asian Studies, which belongs to a larger division called Language-Based Area Studies. Now, Dagmar, you probably laugh at this image. She was my dear colleague. 6 years ago, when I announced to my family and friends I was going to make this an institutional move from the history of science, technology, and medicine to East Asian studies, one of my dear colleagues and friends, Kikuchi Yoshiyuki, who specializes in the history of chemistry in modern Japan, complimented me for having made such a brave plunge into an unknown world. But to me, receiving the comment, my new institutional identity initially didn't mean much. As for many of you here, the move from HSDM to area studies came out of necessity. As a postdoc with a fixed-term contract, I was more desperate than brave, and I got the position simply because I went where the job was. So far, I was simply grateful that I was able to I was in the situation where I could carry on my research. And there was certainly a disconnect in me as a teacher in the East Asian Studies department and as a researcher doing or looking at an East Asian or Japanese history of medicine and beyond as well. So today I've been asked to reflect on the field of East Asian HSDM. Well, not asked to, but given an opportunity to reflect on this. And so the preparation for this today's talk has given me ample opportunity to have a good think about possibilities of considering East Asian HSDM in the light of East Asian studies. So these are the two academic fields I'm currently engaging in my research and teaching. So after all, both East Asian studies and East Asian history and science, technology, and medicine by default have a focus on East Asia. Both also grapple with the ways in which scholars should engage Asia, and here I'm quoting historian of technology Susanna Moon, by thinking through the consequences and obligations of bringing our scholarship to wider communities. So I wonder then how reflections on East Asian studies as area studies could help us overcome our ongoing anxiety over using East Asia as an analytical framework in our historical inquiry and steer our attention away or to a more productive move venue to questions such as how to make our historical inquiries less of an acquired taste in Asia, to borrow Gregory Clancy's expression. And if so, how can we approach our research? So my talk today is an exploration of the question of how applying emerging arguments and methods about area studies to our historical inquiries of East Asian science, history of science, technology, and medicine can be a productive exercise. As many of you know, might have already guessed, I'm here participating in the ongoing debate unfolding in the journal East Asian Science, Technology, and Society about the use of East Asia or Asia as an analytical framework for the analysis of science, technology, and medicine. The participants in these debates are scholars such as Warwick Anderson, Francesca Ray, Raylene Chen, Gregory Clancy, Dai-Wei Fu, Fatih Fan, Sung-Yok Hun, Hong, Maurice Law, Togo Tsukahara, to name but a few. In particular, I am very inspired and at the same time intrigued by Warwick Anderson's proposal to apply Asia as method, as a heuristic tool to our inquiries into science, technology, and medicine of East Asia. I think Asia as method, framed as a de-imperializing enterprise, is something we could take seriously. And already our colleagues such as John DeMoya and Aaron Moore and many, many of you who are here and have given really exciting papers are doing and engaging with it by demonstrating parallel and kind of intersected intra-regional and transnational histories of science, technology, and medicine centering on East Asia. But I'm also sympathetic to those scholars who express concerns about an, I suppose, uncritical celebration of Asia as method. In response, I argue that one way to tackle this would be to reappraise the perspectives advanced by the field of metageography since the 1990s and consider how knowledges and practices in science, technology, and medicine in East Asia were entangled with shared ideas and identities that are predicated on the view on Asia as a geographic and geopolitical entity. So what I'm going to embark on now is my humble attempt to do that. So in order to engage with the question, I'll use the case studies from my current research on the Japanese family campaign in Asia during the Cold War period, packaged as international cooperation and development aid. I'll show how Japan's participation in international cooperation in family planning was supported by multiple claims about Asia, while at the same time, rather ironically, the campaign happened at the specific moment of the Cold War era, in which the category of the world by regions, such as Asia, was crystallized as a result of negotiations within foreign policy and academia, and this led to the expansion of area studies. So this is my attempt, I suppose, to participate in a collective project to approach East Asian SDM, HSDM, sorry, with critical eyes, and by adopting the perspective that regard area studies as a method as and also a subject of inquiry, in part so that we can better engage Asia, right, past and present. So before I introduce my case study, let me kind of elaborate on the debate on the use of East Asia as an analytical framework that's going on recently. Because that's something, something that gives an identity to what we do. So the first point I'd like to raise is that basically we have been having an awkward relationship with East Asia used as an adjective to describe our intellectual endeavor. The debate within and between an East Asian SDS and history of science, technology, and medicine over the nature of East Asian mode of critical mode of critical engagement with the studies of science, technology, and medicine has often stumbled over the question of how we should define East Asia. But our angst over the consideration of East Asia as an analytical framework is not a standalone concern of our own, because it mirrors a larger trend in academia that has been grappling with the notion of Asia as area mobilized for various purposes. So out of this concern emerged the Inter-Asia Cultural Studies, as many of you know, around the turn of the millennium, which had a critical eye on the triumphalist rhetoric of the rise of Asia that pervaded the region since the 1980s. And out of that move emerged Guan Xincheng's proposal to study Asia as method. Now, historian of medicine Warwick Anderson has seen the development in what he called post-colonial area studies, out of which Asia as method, this come out, and proposed that we should take this seriously as a heuristic tool to approach East Asian science, technology, and society. So what is Asia as method? Now, Asia as method as a concept was originally suggested by a Japanese national sinologist, Yoshimi Takeuchi, and was taken up by Guan Xincheng as a way to, and I quote him, transcend the existing understandings of Asia and thereby change the world. So I suppose for Chen, Asia as method is both a political and theoretical movement that pursues possibilities of decolonizing Asian subjectivities by the awareness of Asia's post-colonial geographical and historical conditions, by the transformation of the self and by the recognition of knowledge production with what he called Asia studies in Asia. Anderson argues that area studies, which he thinks shelters Asia as method, is inherently a post-colonial project, and urges us to take it seriously, and specifically proposes that we strive to fragment and multiply Asianness. And Anderson encourages us to imagine global Asia as an effective way to integrate area studies, with the studies of science, technology, and medicine. My initial reaction to proposals by Chen and Anderson is that East Asian history, science, technology, and medicine could easily be an integral part of Asia as method, as a movement, insofar as the de-imperialization mission is concerned. Because critical history, which I believe and definitely is what we do, is understood to be a tool with which to kind of attain its articulated goal. And we are already doing that. I can also see values in embracing Chen's call for Asian studies in Asia, in East Asian HSDM as an exercise to decenter and provincialize the Euro and Anglophone-centric mode of knowledge production, because it still lingers in the field of HSDM. At the same time, I find myself feeling somewhat uncomfortable with a certain interpretation of Chain's call for Asian studies in Asia, in the communities of East Asian SDS, that it affirms the production of unique theories arising from the region of East Asia. Maybe my feeling has to do with the issue of disciplinary boundary between HSDM and SDS regarding how we think of theory. Or it could well be that the sense of discomfort I'm having around this rather celebratory take on Chain's Asian studies in Asia is rooted in the kind of ongoing identity politics that confront me in my everyday life as a so-called non-Western academic participating in the perpetuation of the very Western institution that has come under criticism by that particular understanding of Asian studies in Asia. Or my feeling might be entirely irrelevant for an intellectual conversation I'm trying to establish now, because after all, it just is my personal experience and it's subjective. But having said that, I also think that it can raise an important question about a critical engagement of area studies in the age of globalization, which is, how can we have a generative and transformative dialogue about Asia, about the self, when the dialogue itself is premised on the geographically essentialist claim? And also, if the situation of researchers themselves is constantly in flux and destabilized by various vectors of the post-Cold War era. And equally important is the question of why this kind of essentialism continues to work on various levels in various sites, including science, technology, and policy, as we know, and even in the academia. Now, I cannot single-handedly provide an answer to these questions that require complex thinking. And so I hope we as a collective can keep asking the questions together. But despite the setbacks and pitfalls Asia as method might present to us, or that a reflection of it presents to us, I still see values in bringing it together, our intellectual endeavor, precisely because I believe Asia as method, and more broadly area studies in which Asia as a method lends itself to, could help us achieve what we want to achieve with relevant practical and conceptual tools if our goal is, as Warwick Anderson urged, to decolonize studies of science, technology. But that doesn't mean we need to uncritically embrace area studies. Here, we might want to remind ourselves of the point that the area studies during the Cold War era, certainly in the context of the US, was an integral part of a modernist project that sought to remake the world in the image of the West. The West as in bracket, right? But it's also the case that area studies itself has gone through its period of decolonization over the 1990s, after the end of the Cold War and after when it lost its influential patronage and was confronted with financial as well as epistemological crises. Area studies research and teaching, even in the post-war crisis post-crisis and post-Cold War global capitalist world, according to David Zanton, continues to flag its mission of deparochialized US and Eurocentric visions of the world. It demonstrates the limitations of fashioning analysis based largely on the often idealized narrative of the West, And also it can provide more effective tools for social and cultural analysis. Now, I have to note that this sense of euphoria from the statements should be read against the backdrop that the work leading to the statements was sponsored by the Ford Foundation, one of the core institutions that actually supported area studies in the Cold War politics in the US. Despite this, I believe if we are serious about the role of East Asian HSDM for a broader scholarship and a wider community, the benefit of area studies stressing these points is obvious, or seems obvious. Also, area studies, at least in the European and North American higher education setup, is one of the few academic fields that insist on intensive language learning. And so it provides non-native speakers of Asian languages with a practical tool with which to participate in a colonial, post-colonial, and post-Cold War academia and political and social movement. Now, as many of you have noted, what I've been saying so far might not be so novel. But when it comes down to the question of how, I think we could have more scholarly discussion. So I dare ask, how can we, as historians of East Asian science, technology, and medicine, effectively use area studies as a tool for an analysis of science, technology, and medicine in East Asia? Or if you're so political as to wishing to directly engage with the current politics, the question could be, how can we participate in the Asia as Method project without assenting to geographic determinism and culturally essentialist claims? I don't think I need to solicit a unanimous agreement in response to these questions. But I think that an effective way to deploy area studies in East Asian history of science, technology, and medicine is simply do what historians are good at, which is tell story and tell more. Specifically, we should tell stories of how the entanglement of science, culture, politics, and values in East Asia intersected with the strategic deployment of Asia as a code or a moral imagination. So I suppose what I'm trying to say here echoes with what anthropologist Anya Lumba and colleagues call the destabilization of received geopolitical categories, and or what Fatih Fan's suggestion that we must consider how science technology has helped define East Asia and vice versa. So I'll try that method now in the next session, section of my talk, by telling stories from my case studies, stories of the Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning. So the phrase Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning has a double meaning. On the one hand, it refers to the name of the non-governmental organization that I study for my current research about the Japanese family planning campaigns deployed under the name of International Health and Development Aid between the 1960s and 80s. Now, with the acronym JOICFP, which is pronounced as JOICEF, the Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning was conceived in April 1968 as a foundation specializing in the promotion of family planning as development aid and maternal and child health. Now, as an organization with the adjective Japanese, but its core mission or core agenda encouraging international exposure, JOICEF was both domestic and international in outlook. So as you can see in its official chart here, on the one hand, JOICEF was always connected to the Japanese government despite its non-governmental status. But on the other, JOICEF was also accountable to international players, the most powerful of of the powerful influential to the organization was the one on the upper end, upper hand, IPPF, International Planned Parenthood Federation, which has its central office in London. So I'm kind of shifting a little bit. Okay, so with this structure, what did the Joseph do? Okay, so one of the first things that Joseph did was to donate goods to the local family planning organizations in Nepal, Indonesia, and Taiwan under the coordination of the IPPF. Now, additionally, from 1970, at the request of government agencies, Joseph organized various seminars and conferences on family planning that catered to health practitioners, policymakers, and family planning advocates from various developing countries, and also Japanese healthcare professionals who were interested in family planning and international cooperation. And this picture, which is not a good resolution, not quality, but it shows it's a scene from one of the meetings in the early 1970s. Seminars. So finally, from the mid-1970s, with the financial support of the Japan Shipbuilding Industry Foundation, Joseph developed its own family planning initiative called Integration Project, now which combined family planning with parasite control under one initiative. I'll talk about the Integration Project later. So here I've listed up some basic facts about the institution called the Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning. But earlier I told the organization's name had a double meaning. And so now I'd like to spend a little time for the other meaning. In other words, the ways in which actors affiliated with Joseph articulated how there was a specifically Japanese way of organizing international cooperation in family planning. I'm doing this now because it will lead to a more relevant discussion on the use of area studies for East Asian HSDM. Now, in considering the Japanese organization for international, early in the morning, but Japanese organization for family planning in international cooperation, I'd like us to first come back to the use of adjective Japanese here in the organization's name. On this point, many may say I shouldn't read too much into the deployment of the adjective. After all, it simply specified the fact that the foundation was founded and located in Japan, and to an extent accountable to the Japanese government. But if it represented various efforts within the organization that presented what Joseph did as inherently tied to some aspects of Japanese-ness, which it did, then I think we need to pay attention to the semantics, because it suggests that not only politics of the world areas, but also geopolitics might have had a profound influence on the shaping, deployment, and ramification of Joseph's initiatives. So then, did actors understand there were specifically Japanese ways of international cooperation? And if so, what geopolitical connections or frames of reference were at stake so as to encourage the actors to make such claims? So linked to this question, something that struck me when I was doing archival research was that health activist and Joseph's general secretary, Chojiro Kuniyi, who invented the integration project, which I introduced earlier, he stressed that the project was humanistic. So I also saw that this characterization of Joseph's initiative was directly linked to Kuniyi's claim that the project was unique to Japan. Now, according to Kuniyi, IP was humanistic IP as an integration project because it originated from the experience of family planning campaign in 1950s Japan, which he considered was pillared by some humanistic features. For instance, Kuni mentioned that Japanese government's birth control campaign during the period did not advance the population control agenda, top-down population control agenda, or coercive, you could say that, but put up a more humanistic slogan about the protection of maternal health. Now, if you're a Japan specialist, if you know about the history of reproductive health in Japan, you will know that this presentation of Kuni's, this interpretation was partial. But also, what's interesting is that Japan presented here was also not a static entity, but instead constructed through a specific interpretation of Japan's historical development. So according to this interpretation, Japan was able to escape from a hungry, poor, overpopulated, and underdeveloped state of the immediate post-war period in a matter of two decades because of family planning. Here, an active remembering of Japan's past was an essential component that enabled Kuni to highlight the originality of Joseph's project. Also, this characterization of Joseph's integration project intersected with Kuni's assertion that the project should be juxtaposed with the international, which he saw embodied powerful and interventionist Western population control measures. And I argue that this specific portrayal was predicated on the understanding of Japan's socioeconomic position as somewhere in between. In particular, the claim often heard in the 1960s that Japan was a semi-developed country critically granted Japanese actors the license to claim that Japan could actually understand both sides. In other words, kind of Western donors developed Western donors in international development aid on the one hand, and underdeveloped Asia subject to Western initiatives on the other. So the Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning relied on fictions of geography. Now at this point, it might be also relevant to mention that Joseph at the beginning of its existence specifically articulated its focus on Asia. We set up the council in order to help improve the living standard and welfare in the people of the Asian area. And this was the statement, the beginning, the kind of opening statement of the Joseph's parent organization, Japanese Council on Family Planning International Cooperation. Right? It's an opening statement in the mission statement. And it goes on, we wish for peace and prosperity in Asia, and we can achieve that mission by applying our past experience and techniques. Attached to this statement was a familiar image invoking third world poverty with the caption, "Countries in Asia awaiting our aid." Here, I want to point out the notion of blank slate that prevailed in the depiction of Asia, which existed in reference to Japan. In other words, Asia in this formulation was a monolithic virgin land where we Japanese could apply our past experience and techniques onto. It was a place that allowed the Japanese actors to feel a sense of entitlement and even responsibility to bring a new set of rules about how to discipline bodies and families, and even to rewrite future scenario. The treatment of Asia in the mission statement was sympathetic, yet at the same time incredibly patronizing, partly because Asia was characterized as homogeneous and childlike, in comparison to Japan that seems to be conferred autonomy and authority. To be fair, for Joseph's focus on Asia didn't simply emerge from within Japan or the thing called Japanese organization, but was in part shaped by the transnational discourse of overpopulation and underdevelopment. The argument that Asia was a problem region for the world population emerged from the community of American and European demographers during the early 1940s. The experts claim public health measures promoted in the region as a goodwill gesture of the international health community ironically caused overpopulation by lowering mortality rates. So in response, in 1948, the Rockefeller Foundation, as many of you know, is a US-based philanthropist long supporting international health. So the foundation commissioned two noted American demographers, Frank Notstein and Irene Teuber, from the Office of Population Research at Princeton University. They commissioned these demographers to a reconnaissance trip to East Asia. And they asked, the foundation asked them to investigate the state of demography and public health in the region. Now, I won't go into details of the trip, but what I want to point out with the episode is that this helped to forge networks among American and Japanese public health experts and demographers, such as Warren S. sociologist and public health, family planning advocate Warren S. Thompson, and also Japanese Yoshio Koya, who was the director of the National Institute of Public Health, and also an advocate of family planning, who actually sit in the council I was talking about, council promoting family planning later. This collaboration, in fact, shaped the idea of Asia. These networks helped to shape the image of Asia that laid a foundation for the establishment of Joseph in later years. So in parallel, the Cold War climate also encouraged the US-Japan cooperation among politicians and businessmen for the promotion of family planning in Asia. So over the 1950s, theories of modernization and demographic transition in social science consolidated the view that excess fertility in Asia and other third world regions was coterminous to poverty, underdevelopment, and political instability, potentially promoting the spread of communism. Crucially, it was this notion of fertile yet politically dangerous Asia that allowed space for some of the unusual suspects, not usual suspects, to get involved in family planning, which so far had been reserved for progressive activists or doctors and or doctors. So these were economists, technocrats, politicians, policymakers, and so on. And one influential figure was American businessman and foreign policy advisor William H. Draper. So Draper's report, The Population Explosion, published in 1959, warned of the serious political ramification of overpopulation for Cold War politics and mobilized U.S. foreign policy for the global promotion of population control in the 1960s, as some of you know. And so it was this context of U.S. foreign policy that acted as a drive for the establishment of Joseph. In the summer of 1968, partly at the request of Kuni, Draper visited Japan as part of his Asian tour in order to garner support for his campaign for transnational population control initiatives in Asia. During the visit, Draper met former Prime Minister Kishi Nobusuke, and this led to the establishment of Joseph. And again, Kishi, like Koya, were in this in the advisory board that advising Joseph. So as you can see, US-Japan political dialogue during the Cold War also played an important role in the JOICEF and Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning and its focus on Asia. But I want to stress the heterogeneity in the story here. What Asia meant differed among actors, even within the JOICEF. For instance, for Kishi, Japanese international cooperation in family planning was an extension of Japanese involvement in the economic development in Southeast Asia. Since the kind of pre-war period, Kishi saw the benefit of Southeast Asia's economic presence for Japan's prospects. So another important factor was Kishi's understanding of Japan's position vis-a-vis People's Republic of China in Cold War Asia. So Kishi, PRC's quick commercial expansion to Southeast Asia and its rising prominence in the international movement, non-allied movement, encouraged Kishi to assert Japan's center was not or should not be communist China, but Japan. The claim was critical for the engagement with his engagement with JOICEF, which he regarded as a tool of international diplomacy. So in contrast, Kuni had a different view on Asia. Although Kuni, like Kishi, believed in a kind of Asian brotherhood, which he attributed to the shared ethnic origin, for Kuni, Asia was far from a blank slate, but was filled with people with distinctive cultures. The difference in the interpretation of Asia between Kishi and Kuni was in part informed by their different ideological stance. As many of you know, Kishi was a member of the creme de la creme in the political world of Japan and was also known for his ultra-conservative ideology and notorious bureaucratic maneuvering in wartime Manchuria. And partly because of this, the Asia Kishi saw was either a faceless blank slate or represented by a small group of local elites he met on his duty. In contrast, Kuni was a politically left-leaning health activist who believed in humanity. So he stressed that knowing local people and their cultures should be a priority in any family planning activity. There were other actors that I could introduce here who kind of introduced different kind ideas of Asia, such as Kato Shizue. But my point here is to highlight that competing and often contradictory claims of Asia were at the foundation of JOICEF's mission statement. Despite the difference in the interpretation of what should constitute Asia as a recipient area, the focus on Asia did determine JOICEF's actions and eventually in 1974 motivated the pilot scheme of its own initiative, the Humanistic Integration Project. Now, Integration Project was an ambitious initiative that combined family planning with a public health initiative focusing on parasite eradication. It was Kuni's original idea, partly because it kind of grew out of his experience as a, he started as, he was a an activist in parasite eradication in the 50s, who turned into kind of family planning in the 60s, well, in the 50s, late 50s. But the idea behind it was that family planning was a sensitive topic for many people, so to ease the tension and embarrassment, family planning would be introduced following a parasite control initiative. And also, Kuni argued that people would see a dramatic effect with the parasite eradication initiative. So it would be an effective tool, as it were, effective way to introduce. Introduce family planning initiative. So, and after the parasite control, through the parasite control initiative, he argued, health campaigner or health practitioner and local people would have a sense of rapport, and that helps another stage of this initiative, which is the introduction or popularization of family planning. Now, the first site where the pilot scheme was conducted was in Nantou Prefecture in Taiwan. As you may have guessed already, the identification of Nantou as the location of the pilot project was not simply accidental. Instead, it resulted from inter-regional and transnational networks, which were informed by two kinds of vectors. The first one was the Trans-Pacific Network of Population Control I've explained earlier. I've explained that the globalizing discourse of overpopulation created the US-Japan network, but in parallel, it has also mobilized networks in other sites of East Asia centering on the US. So there was, you know, in parallel between US and Japan, there's the US South Korea, US Taiwan networks, US India networks. And so this kind of these multi-regional networks within Asia that all responded to the US foreign policy facilitated the identification of sites for JOICEF's pilot schemes. Another intersecting vector was the intra-regional network that relied on the structure of Japanese colonialism. The pilot schemes of the integration project relied on the networks forged by the Asian Parasite Control Organization called APCO. And here is a scene from one of the meetings there. APCO was launched in October 1974, and Kishi really was at the center of the organization. He really ran around to set up this organization, and APCO is with it's with and for experts from South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan, parasitologists. So based on these networks, JOICEF identified South Korea's, sorry for my pronunciation, Gyeonggi province as the site for the international integration project after Nantou. And this was realized by the collaboration between Kuni and South Korean parasitologist Byeok Seo-seol and then C.C. Lee. I have yet to find out how these personal relationships might have been shaped through how the kind of legacy of colonialism played out in these kind of networks. But it is also indicative that these networks, so the pilot studies first was located in Taiwan and then South Korea. It is indicative of the legacy of Japanese colonialism in post-war Japan's deployment of health diplomacy. Then what happened under the JOICEF project, so pilot schemes in Nantou and Gyeonggi province, or Sawalunto in Indonesia, town of Karamuan in the Philippines, and Banlamon district in Thailand, where the pilot schemes were also conducted, was mobilized. Now, I don't have time to detail how the pilot project developed in each district, but what I can say is that the goods that were transferred under broader initiatives of JOICEF to different destinations in Asia turn out to be very different from site to site. There were many reasons for this, but a most direct reason was that the structure of goods donation depended on the request of the local organizers. And so the demands of the recipients itself were diverse. Another reason was that competing narratives of population control affected the flow of goods, and this created diversity in the delivery of goods. So that meant that on the one hand, some thought a quick fix using oral contraceptives, which were available then already, what would be the best method for both population and parasite control? While others emphasize health education to be a more effective tool in the long run, and one of the activities Joyceph organized in order to raise public awareness for contraception was, as you can see in the picture, it was called the condom blowing competition, and that was however corny that is. It happened in the, this picture came from the Philippines in the 1970s. In practice, in terms of family planning, this meant that sometimes the local officers demanded contraceptives such as condoms, IUDs, foam tablets, while often goods associated less with family planning, such as microbuses, printers, tape recorders, camcorders. They were also donated under the name of family planning initiatives. So that also meant, this also meant that if we focus only on the distribution of contraceptives, it turned out there was a disparity between the contraceptives used in Japan and the contraceptives used under the Japanese family planning initiatives elsewhere. So even if the narrative of Asia prevalent in the official discourse implied a homogeneous blank slate, in reality, diversity characterized the Joyceph initiatives, and this was in part because the actual deployment depended on the interactions between aid workers affiliated with Joyceph and local recipients in various sites in Asia. Now, if multiplying the accounts of heterogeneous Asia and Asianness, and if showing intra and inter-Asian connectedness within the formation of multiplicity in Asia are important objectives of Asia as method in area studies, as Chan argues, then the value of my stories would be simply that they are able to offer another case study. The image of Asia that prevailed in and around Joyceph was heterogeneous, yet incredibly fixed at the same time. It was constructed in reference to a certain interpretation of Japan's recent past and its in-between position, or self-assumed in-between position in the Cold War, between the developed free world, represented by the US, and the underdeveloped third world, represented by Asia. But in no ways did the Japanese actors monopolize the characterization of Asia, and did the Asia imagined by actors trigger a singular response. Instead, intra and inter-regional networks played a pivotal role. The cooperation centering on the sites of cosmopolitan Washington, Tokyo, Seoul, Taipei, which itself was informed by specific historical conditions in each site, mobilized the Japanese development aid in Asia's province, such as Nantou Prefecture and Gyeonggi Province. Asia in my stories was as much a geopolitical reality as a geographical imaginary, which mobilized Japan's family planning initiatives. But what I also wanted to do with my talk today was to consider how we could use area studies, and in particular Asia as method for our historical inquiries into East Asian Sci-Med tech. To respond to this, I hope my stories highlighted the significant role science, technology, and medicine played in negotiations on the local, regional, and transnational levels over competing understandings of Asia and Asianness. My stories, I hope, show the ways in which these understandings of Asia shaped certain modes of operation in science, technology, and medicine during the time of the Cold War. So in sum, my stories told how science, technology, and medicine in and from Japan were embedded in the process whereby narratives of Asia were constantly produced in the negotiations over how many people should be reproduced in Asia. Area studies certainly has helped me to widen my intellectual horizon with which I could seize the entangled relationships between science, history, and geography, and I hope it will be the case for some of you here as well. Thank you very much.
Hi. Thank you very much for this talk on a very important, complex, and relevant topic, and you put it in such an inspiring fashion. I think it is fascinating. Thank you so much for beginning our day with this fascinating talk. I think we still have some time for discussion,
okay.
Although I'm not, I'm sorry to say. Maybe we accept three to four short questions, and so that we allow some time for Dr. Homme to answer the questions.
Sure.
Okay. Any question from the floor? Catherine?
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. I think it's, in a sense, also central for this conference, because the notion of East Asia has been defined by pre-modernists as the area where classical Chinese was the vehicle of scholarly language. So it's clearly a definition from pre-20th century. As I was listening to you, I was thinking about Asia as method, which is linked to the word decolonizing. And I think here we still have a big silence that is profoundly Eurocentric, and it maybe needs to be said explicitly. Who says that colonization was done by Westerners? What you have described to us is post Japanese colonial empire networks that still rely on links with it, which are colonial, and it would not be unfair to describe China as the only contemporary country that has still retained most of its colonial expansion through history. So maybe facing the fact that Asia is an actor and not a patient in colonial history is very much needed to, as a supplement to the picture you have, well, not what you are saying, but the way you have described current East Asia STS discussions.
Yeah, thank you very much, Catherine. I think what I wanted to highlight is also to really, rather than kind of give a counter story from Asia, I think what I wanted to highlight is that first of all, how Japan dealt with its colonial legacy and hasn't. And I think one way to do it is to kind of really highlight how Japanese, after the war, it was occupied for the first time, and then how it kind of was forgot the colonial past, but also to highlight that not only the Japanese uniqueness of post-colonial history, but also to really map out in the world kind of history how Japanese colony was made and has been remembered. I think that's what I want to, and how that kind of has an impact on today's current politics, and how this kind of Japan articulates itself in the discourse of Asia today. So, for instance, Asian mode of humanitarian aids or and such. It kind of, again, Japanese actors and political actors are trying to kind of rebrand their, activities to fit in this discourse.
Thank you so much for your talk. It's very, very inspiring. My question is, you mentioned that the organization JOICEF as being a humanistic project, which is you then said is being partial. I'm just wondering, in hindsight, whether you would be thinking that this organization is somewhat patronizing, thinking that the people who work for that organization, we the Japanese have the responsibility to help other Asian countries with their birth control. So do you think this might be the residue of Japanese colonialism?
Mm.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. I think to judge whether it was whether it was, you know, patronizing or not, or to, I suppose, make a verdict on that, has been actually done by various scholars in development, you know, big development studies. I suppose what I want to say is, as a historian, I think our task is to really highlight how these condescending views have been made, and what was happening there, rather than to make a verdict on it. I think that's and give a counter narrative to that sort of argument, because I think to give a verdict on one and try to find roots in, say, you know, in, that this was actually, you know, built on really patronizing Japanese colonialism, I think it kind of stops the arguments there. So,
thank you. I think we still have time for one more question. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. It was very interesting and very, for me, also very useful. And there are lots, a lot of things to think about, and it takes some time to digest. So, but one question. So it's great that, so basically for me, you are trying to deal with Asia as a kind of actors category, so to discuss Asia as a scene from certain Japanese actors. Rather than, so by doing so, you are able to avoid essentializing the Asia. So that's very great. But also, I'd like to know how far you would go. Because by saying this, you are, in a way, it's a, you are seeing Asia from Japanese perspective rather than Asia itself, and also, and you would say, you would go, you would deal Asia as something, kind of some sort of concept used by, consistently used by the historical actors rather than analyzers, not as analyzer categories, or whatever the categories. Or would you still think there's something Asia out there?
Okay, thank you very much. I think there are several ways to approach this. I think one way we could do is to really highlight Kwan Shin Chen's argument that this reference, you know, we just create more multiple reference points. So one way, practical way of doing it is to literally collaborate with, so one thing is that there is language barrier. Okay, so Asian studies in Asia is a great ideal, but as we all know, and many of us have a language impediment or a language limitation, and I'm really inspired by the new generation of scholars who are really fluent in Chinese, Korean, and Japanese, and that's just wonderful. But I think one way is to do it is to literally complicate our stories, right? So, for instance, I collaborate with people in who are looking at the Japan, U.S. Taiwan. Story in there, and how this kind of this story, parallel story, was developed. I'm collaborating with John DeMoya here, who is looking at U.S. South Korea story. So to really complicate and really kind of highlight different referential points, you know, how did they see Japan? How did they, you know, how did South Korean pastoralists look at Japan? How did Japanese family planning experts look at Taiwan, for instance, right? So that's one way. The other is trickier. You know, this kind of Asia as category, of course, it recurs, and it does, you know, really influence, as we know, our politics and activities nowadays. Like I said earlier, you know, the buzz in humanitarian aids and international development aids nowadays is really like there's this Asian mode of humanitarian aid. Now, so what is it, you know? But I think one way is to overcome this kind of, of course, there's essentialism all the way through. One way to overcome this essentialism is, I mean, this is something I learned recently from a great anthropologist of aid workers, Heather Hindman from Texas. She's looking at how this where the essentialist claim comes from. And I think, you know, as historians of science, technology, and medicine, of course, we are inclined to look at, you know, specific sources, but to move away from that sources. And so she's looking at aid workers, right? But she's in Nepal, but she's looking at how some kind of different Korean and Chinese and Japanese aid workers operate in Nepal. But she's looking at, rather than looking at aid workers themselves and how they say, she's actually looking at their social interactions in Chinese restaurant or Korean restaurant. And now, that's not really, I mean, so she's looking at the social interactions away from the actual doing practices. But she thinks that the area, the sites of social interactions that play with the idea of cultural essentialism need to be taken seriously, right? So that's how we could, I suppose, maybe overcome analytically a kind of essentialism and by looking at where it comes from.
So I think I'm sure that you still have a lot of questions, and this talk will inspire a lot of further research, but I'm afraid that we don't have the time today. But before we end, I think we will thank Aya Homé for this very inspiring talk, and then we will ask Catherine to say a few words on organizational logistical matters. Thank you.
Thank you.